This is East End Ink. This month at Canio's Books, Yale professor Lauren Young talked about her book Hitler's Girl, The British Aristocracy and the Third Reich on the Eve of World War II. Here is a part of her talk.
I realize that when we talk about fascism and we look at the rise of authoritarianism in our world today, we tend to look at Germany, we look at Vichy France, we look at Mussolini's Italy, and nobody thinks about England. Why is that? We think of England as really being the bulwark of our democracy, the leader of the democratic world, not one that was challenged in their democracy. But I think that was really the opportunity to go back, and it's incumbent on us to go back and to look at history and to look at what challenge our beliefs and to understand what there is that we have to learn from those beliefs. And my book hopefully will be surprising to you. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my book and a little bit about why, you know, specifically how I got to this topic. So as you mentioned so kindly in your introduction, I started my career really as a political advisor at the Security Council of the United Nations. And I was a nuclear negotiator. And as my career more broadly focused on what we call at the UN threats to international peace and security, I started thinking that it was really very curious that we all basically agree on nuclear proliferation. We believe in nuclear deterrence. You know, even the outliers on the Security Council, we could find consensus about nuclear weapons. What we haven't found consensus on is our democracy and how to defend it. And I really believe that in today's world, every little chink in the armor matters dramatically. So as a researcher, as a social scientist, I jumped back into the period of the 1930s in England. And what I found was alarmingly similar to what's going on today. And I love to quote Mussolini. It's the first quote of my book, and I'll give it to you now. If you pluck a chicken one feather at a time, nobody notices. And I really believe that that's what's happening in our world today. So this idea of a post-Second World War neoliberal democracy that rose from the ashes of the Allied defeat of Nazi Germany and was cemented by the fall of the Berlin Wall as the cornerstone of our Western tradition is currently under siege. We have long assumed that democracy is our heritage and our Western birthright. And today that heritage is being severely challenged by a resurgence of right-wing agitation, and it's symbolized by the Brexit vote, creeping autocracy, as we see in this horrible war that Putin is waging in the Ukraine. Eastern Europe, Poland, who's having a good moment by taking all of these poor Ukrainian refugees. I hope they maintain their good record. The Hungary of Viktor Orban, debates about immigration in this country that we've never seen before, separating children at our southern border, attacks on democratic institutions such as the free press and free elections, and of course Donald Trump is president. My students love to ask me, and I'll head this question off right now, what my political position is. And what I like to say is that I believe in democracy, and I think we should all really be giving that a good think right now. So while historians are really looking at historical models of, as I mentioned, Germany or France or Italy, nobody looked in England. And what I found in England during the period of the 1930s is really quite alarming and something I hope that we'll all think about when you read this book. There are many implicit parallels to England in the 1930s and today's world, and one of the most troubling of those is complacency and its repercussions. from Chamberlain's policy of appeasement to a groundswell of support for Hitler among the British ruling classes, the future of democracy turned on the head of a pin in England during this period. And the potential for Britain to succumb to Nazi Germany was a real possibility and probability that was avidly advanced by the country's elite and systematically covered up by its government as too dangerous to reveal, even decades later. So the statute of limitations on a lot of the research that I've undertaken for this book began to expire on classified material, interestingly, around the same time that these challenges started to arise in our world. So it was very fortuitous for me as a researcher, and very interesting that nobody else is really looking at it. As a backdrop to this period, and perhaps a fresh way of looking at this period, in the same year that Time designated its Man of the Year, 1938, to be Adolf Hitler, let's think about that, Joseph Kennedy, the American ambassador to England, the Court of St. James, and of course the scion of the scion of the Kennedy family, stated in an interview, "Democracy is finished in England. It may be here in the U.S. too. Britain's relationship to America was really central during this period. Britain could not survive another World War. They had lost a generation of young men during World War I, and the probability that Britain might fall to the Nazis was real. And Chamberlain, who referred to himself in private correspondence with Roosevelt as a former naval person, sent Roosevelt a series of texts, cables, asking for help, asking for military help, asking for armaments, because he saw a war coming and he saw an invasion coming and knew that Britain couldn't defend itself. All of these cables were stolen by a cipher clerk in the U.S. Embassy, a young guy named Tyler Kent, who worked with a fellow right-wing compatriot named Anna Walkoff, a white Russian whose family owned a tea room in Kensington, if any of you know central London, where all of the right-wing supporters in England would gather at the time. And Anna Walkoff persuaded Tyler Kent, the cipher clerk, to steal whatever he could. And he did. And all of these cables between Churchill and all of the cables between Churchill and Roosevelt were passed to the Nazis, revealing just how weak militarily Britain was on the eve of the Second World War. So that's just one story to give you as backdrop. Another one, which people don't really think about that much, is anti-Semitism in the UK. Active anti-Semitism in Britain during the decade of the 1930s were frequently recorded by Jewish newspapers and almost never prosecuted. A special parliamentary debate on a wave of anti-Semitic incidents across London was called in July of 1936, and the MP for Hammersmith, one of the few outliers defending the Jewish communities in Britain, claimed that there would be pogroms in this country if action was not taken to support and defend the Jewish communities. Synagogues were vandalized in Leeds, Gateshead, Manchester, and many parts of London. The Gateshead Synagogue alone was desecrated two or three times a week in 1935 and papered with posters urging "Down with the Jews." A pig's head was left at a synagogue on Bethnal Green, also central London, during Passover of 1939, and boycotts of Jewish-owned shops were urged across the country. Pro-Nazi publications became frequent in Britain as well during this time. Mein Kampf, Hitler's famous autobiography, was actually issued in 1936 in an English language version to benefit the British Red Cross. The future Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, sponsored a 1940 publication called Unfinished Victory. Macmillan, as in Macmillan Publishing, that'll be familiar to many of you. This book was written by a leading British historian named Arthur Bryant, and it was a work which was advanced by the Nazi Reich and was specifically anti-Semitic. The book was published by Macmillan and Company, with Harold Macmillan acting as Bryant's personal contact and representative for this book. Other stories that I have to tell, some of which will be more familiar to you than others, is the story of Ribbentrop, who during the period of the 1930s, 1936 to 1938, was the German ambassador to Britain and then the Nazi foreign minister. He was one of the first war criminals to be tried and condemned to death at Nuremberg. Recently declassified intelligence files reveal that both Anthony Eden, who was the foreign minister at the time, and King George VI knew Ribbentrop before his appointment to London as ambassador, and were so enthusiastic about his posting that they waived the customary formal vetting for the position. At his trial at Nuremberg, Ribbentrop called a long roster of British aristocrats to his defense, even asking Churchill to speak on his behalf. Suddenly, by the Nuremberg trials, none of that materialized.
This is East End Inc. Author Lauren Young is talking about her book, Hitler's Girl, The British Aristocracy and the Third Reich on the Eve of World War II.
There's the story of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor that we discuss in this book, perhaps with a new twist. And that was that Ribbentrop sent 13 carnations every day to Wallis Simpson and had recruited her to be a German spy, and suggesting that she was in fact both his mistress and a secret German agent who recruited the future King of England. While much has been written about the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, this book shows how Ribbentrop actually ran them both as intelligence assets and used his position to lure them to Spain in 1940, where Hitler made direct overtures to Edward to restore him as a puppet king to the throne once the Nazis succeeded in conquering Britain. Exactly what his position on this is unclear and controversial. We do know that Churchill found out about it and promptly sent the Windsors to the Bahamas to sit out the rest of the war, figuring this was about as far in the British kingdom as one could send them, and that they would be out of harm's way, you know, out of the way of harming Britain any further. We know a lot, and probably you've heard of, the British Union of Fascists and Oswald Mosley, who was married to one of the Mitford sisters, Diana Mitford Mosley. Diana Mitford was married to Brian Guinness, the Guinness beer heir, and she left him and two small children to marry Mosley. Mosley, interestingly, had never actually met Hitler. It was her sister, Diana's sister, Unity Mitford, who I speak about quite a bit in the book, who introduced Oswald Mosley to Hitler. Hitler attended their wedding. The wedding of Mosley and Diana Mitford was held at the home of Magda and Joseph Goebbels, who you probably know was Hitler's minister of propaganda. Hitler actually attended their wedding. And then, you know, they were off back on their merry way back to England. But what I found in my research was that the British Union of Fascists was really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of fascist movements in Britain during this period. There were many different societies that were organized, mostly composed of aristocrats, and they ranged from a group who would assemble and function as a shadow government at Clifton House. You might remember Clifton House. It's where Meghan Markle and her mom stayed before she married Prince Harry. So alive and well, this house with a long history. It was also the seat of the Perfumer Affair some years later. But this house, owned at the time by Nancy Astor and her husband, she was an American, in fact. She was the first woman elected to the she was a member of the House of Parliament. They operated a fully right-wing agenda that supported this push for the British aristocracy to support, and the British ruling class to support, Hitler's Germany. I mean, it was really quite remarkable. Another interesting organization that I found in my research and that I wrote about is a group called the Right Club. And the Right Club, I don't know if any of you saw, I wrote a piece about in the Wall Street Journal, five best books on British fascism, of which there are barely five best books to recommend. There's a book about the membership of the Right Club. This included the Duke of Wellington, the Duke of Westmoreland, the heads of all of the major banks in England, the heads of some of the major industrial companies. And this book of membership was considered to be the single most valuable asset of the membership of this club. It was so precious that it was, and so damning, the membership, that to this day, a friend of mine, a dear friend from who I went to university with, runs a big think tank in London, and her principal patron, aside from the Queen, is the Duke of Wellington. And she wrote to me kind of tongue-in-cheek, and she said, well, I'd recommend that you submit the book for our Wellington Prize, but I don't guess that's going to go over too well. And I said, no, it really isn't going to probably go over too well. And I sent her my book. But the membership of the Right Club was so carefully guarded that it was kept underground until 1990, when it was acquired by the Wiener Library, which is the library in Russell Square in central London, dedicated to Holocaust and genocide studies. So that's where that lives these days. Unity Mitford. We know a lot about the Mitford sisters. So much has been written about how eccentric they were. But Unity Mitford met with Hitler, by her own reckoning, over 160 times. She was in love with Hitler. And I'm going to read you a passage today about Unity Mitford's love for Hitler. And what's really interesting about Unity, and you can't make this up, is that she was born, and this is her full name, Unity Valkyrie, like the Wagnerian opera, Mitford. And she was actually born in Swastika, Ontario. So perhaps this was a calling that she would fall in love with Hitler. I mean, it sure feels that way. But what's very interesting is that the British government followed her. They maintained an intelligence file about Unity. They knew she was very close to Hitler, and I'm going to read you a bit about that in a second. But they never tried to use her as an intelligence asset. And for somebody who's worked in government for a long time, I can tell you that typically when government has an opportunity in a moment like this, I can promise you that we're trying to figure out who knows Putin and how, you know, what's the best back channel to get to Putin these days. So it's very troubling that she was never approached. And I tell a long story in the book, and I'm going to tantalize you all with this because it goes in a very reckless direction. So let me read you a bit about Unity to give you an idea. And I never wear glasses in public, but I have to admit that I'm not getting any younger, so I'm going to wear my glasses. To tell you a little bit about how much the British government chose to overlook by not looking into her. Unity Mitford took another intrepid step in support of the Nazi cause, speaking at a rally organized by Julius Streicher in Hesselberg in the hills outside of Nuremberg. Best known for carrying a whip, which he was known to use, Streicher was listed as Nazi number 2 on his party card, compared to Hitler, who was Nazi number 7. Streicher was also the violently anti-Semitic founder of the Nazi newspaper Die Stürmer. It had a modest circulation of 28,000 when Streicher bought it, reaching a circulation of about 100,000 by mid-1935. Streicher knew that Unity had Hitler's ear and was likely opportunistic in putting her on the stage, where she was joined by other Nazi dignitaries, including a deputy propaganda chief. Unity described the scene behind the podium in a letter home. "It is customary in Germany at midsummer midnight to roll great burning wheels from the tops of the hills into the valley. It's the most extraordinary sight to see fiery wheels bowling along down the hill, getting faster and faster." The Frankische Tageszeitung reported that Streicher called Unity up to the swastika-festooned podium and presented her with a big bouquet of flowers, calling her a brave English girl and reading excerpts from the soon-to-be-published interview in Die Stürmer. Unity made a few brief and impromptu remarks about her admiration of Streicher and her support of the Nazi cause, proudly proclaiming, "Everyone should know that I'm a Jew hater." The crowd of 200,000 Nazi Party supporters chanted Heil Hitler as she left the stage. Unity's remarks at the Hesselberg conference garnered Hitler's attention. In a postcard kept by her mother and dated Hesselberg 1935, Hitler wrote, in translation, "You are beautiful. You are my everything. My heart will always belong to you." Coverage in the British newspapers was far less complimentary, calling the Hesselberg gathering a pagan ritual, condemning the daughter of a member of the House of Lords for her comments. Unity responded to the criticism, pleading with them to try to look at the whole thing from my point of view. "I couldn't refuse Streicher's invitations, could I? Firstly, for politeness' sake. Secondly, because I naturally longed to go. When once there, I couldn't refuse the bouquet offered to me, nor could I refuse to go to the microphone when he called for me. Really, I do think it is unkind to write like that, as if I'd done something wicked. Surely all that matters is that it shouldn't go against my own conscience, and it doesn't." In Germany, Unity assumed the role of emissary between the English fascist movement, headed by her soon-to-be brother-in-law, Oswald Mosley, and the Nazi Party. While the British press was mixed in its response, the Daily Mail ran a headline, "Peer's daughter as Jew hater." The reaction to her letter to the Stürmer was widely praised in Germany. She wrote to her family, "I get a lot of letters of praise for my Stürmer letter every day from all parts of Germany. Some of them send me little presents, and one young Austrian SS man who is having to return to Austria while he will be put in prison probably for 5 years came to see me and said that he would like me to have his dagger and swastika armband. Poor thing. I was so sorry for him. The dagger is lovely." The Jewish Chronicle, the British Jewish Chronicle, was dismissive in its reaction to Unity's virulent Die Stürmer letter as a bid for attention by a young lady in need of, quote, traditional discipline. It also accused the British press of publicizing her pronouncements because she was a member of the British aristocracy. In an editorial, the Chronicle observed that she realized that without her title, which of course, a mere accident of birth, her vaporings would have been no more concern to the public than those of any other irresponsible young hussy out to get her name in the papers. However, the British mainstream press was more complimentary. The German correspondent for the Gloucester Citizen, Mick Byrne, an old friend of Unity's, wrote to his parents that Unity, quote, "is terribly grand and very nice. People think quite seriously that she's going to marry Hitler, who gives her lunch parties in his flat." Byrne subsequently toured Dachau, an invitation that came in response to his book, I Was Hitler's Prisoner. Byrne commented that the prisoners of Dachau often Jewish, as early as 1935, represented more of a threat to Germany than the brutal SS soldiers who guarded them. By her own account, Unity's proximity and intimacy with Hitler continued to increase after the events of the summer. In a letter to Diana, Unity recounted, "The Führer talked a good deal about the Jews and said that lately 10,000 have gone from Germany to Italy because there they can do good business in a way of profiteering. He's happy to be rid of them." On Christmas Eve 1935, Unity returned home to her flat in Munich and found in my room a lovely Christmas tree, all decorated with candles and standing in a huge basket, quite full of boxes and chocolates, cakes, biscuits, fruit, and nuts. On it was a card with an eagle and a swastika printed on it, saying, "Fräulein Unity Mitford, best Christmas and New Year's wishes sent from yours faithfully, Adolf Hitler." January 1936, Unity wrote to Hitler's assistant, Gauleiter Wagner, for permission to visit Dachau. Wagner told her that women were generally forbidden to visit a concentration camp, but made an exception for Unity, her sister Diana, and the British journalist Mick Byrne. The Dachau camp had opened outside of Munich in 1933 for political prisoners. While some visitors foresaw the horrors that were to come at Dachau as early as 1936, Unity and Diana and their visiting crew did not register any discomfort. The sudden death of King George V on January 20, 1936, and the accession of his oldest son, Edward VIII, a rumored German sympathizer, provided an important bridge for the Nazi sympathizers in England. The evidence in my book, I believe, systematically paints parallels to the threats to democracy and the challenges of authoritarianism in our world today. And I hope if you read my book that you will understand the gravity of the question whether democracy under siege from remarkably similar threats will again prevail. As I started my talk, it's not obvious that it will, sadly.
This is East End Inc. We heard a portion of a talk by Yale professor Lauren Young about her book Hitler's Girl, The British Aristocracy and the Third Reich on the Eve of World War II. The book was published in August by HarperCollins. A complete recording is at moreeastendinc.blogspot.com. Dr. Lauren Young has previously taught in the Department of International History at the London School of Economics and at the U.S. Mission to the United Nations and the U.S. Embassy in London. Some upcoming literary events in Sag Harbor include on Wednesday, October 12th at 5 p.m. at the Church on Madison Street, author Isabel Vincent presents Overture of Hope, Two Sisters' Daring Plan That Saved Opera's Jewish Stars from the Third Reich. And on Saturday, October 15th at 4:30 p.m. at Canio's Books, acclaimed translator Michael Moore in conversation with bookshop founder Canio Pavone on a new translation of The Betrothed by Alessandro Manzoni. More events are at calendar of events at canios.wordpress.com. East End Inc. is produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Soka.